It's just like, he said she's dead. It doesn't make sense how it could be justified that it's done and closed with. I mean, it is closed now because they closed it, finally released all the released the records, and they blacked out a lot of it, saying that, you know, he's protected by Miranda rights in case there's more evidence that they could take trial eventually.
Now, what police department handled this case?
It was Hamilton County Sheriff's Department.
Was there a specific detective that you dealt with?
Brian Stapleton was one that took over the case after Ken Schweinfest retired. And then there was like a couple of them that we were working with went towards the end that actually went down to Texas and re-interviewed him and his family and like followed him across the country, whatever. I want to say it's been like 3 years since they've actually, since I've bothered reaching out. Since they handed me the case file and I actually read it, I had a few questions I talked to one of the guys with, but nothing else could come of it.
Was her death ruled a homicide or a suicide?
Undetermined. What we believe happened was, like, you know, Sarah, like, obviously a teenager girl, like, when she's younger, she had depression. She's not really suicidal or anything like that. According to the 911 call, he called his mother and got a ride somehow to his mother's house, which is, like, 45 minutes away from where Sarah lived. And they were fighting over the gun, and the gun accidentally went off. What we found out is that the gun was actually, was his, was given to him by somebody, supposedly, in his family. And a few weeks or a few nights before, the gun was taken away from him at a bar that given back to him when he left.
Hello, this is Mark. I write a weekly newspaper column about true crime and unsolved homicides for the Claremont Sun in Ohio. Welcome to the Catch My Killer podcast, and thank you for listening. Before I get into this week's podcast episode, I would like to ask for your help. I'm looking for listeners to help support the podcast by buying me a cup of coffee. I'm asking you to subscribe to my monthly Crime Coffee Club, which is only $5 per month. If you subscribe to my monthly coffee fund, I will share exclusive content with you and eventually commercial-free episodes and extra episodes. And if you enjoy reading about true crime stories, I will also share some really interesting ones with you. If you would like to support the podcast, please visit catchmykiller.com. You can then click on either the donate link or on the buy me a coffee link. And that's enough coffee talk. Now it's time to talk about this week's true crime story. This week's story comes from Cincinnati, Ohio. It involves the death of a 20-year-old woman named Sarah Wallace in July 2007. Sarah Wallace was a young woman with big dreams. She worked at a local pharmacy and had career goals. Unfortunately, she wouldn't live long enough to achieve her dream of attending college and becoming a nurse. However, Sarah had a problem. She confided in her two sister-in-laws, Betsy Wallace and Angela Walters. Sarah told them that she was in a domestic violence relationship. Both sister-in-laws saw bruising on Sarah that she had covered with long-sleeve sweaters. Not only were Betsy and Sarah sister-in-laws, they were best friends. Betsy had assumed the role of Sarah's protector. Betsy and Sarah put together a plan for Sarah to leave her abusive relationship. Sarah was going to move out of her apartment and then move in with her brother and Betsy. It would be a safe haven for Sarah where she could attend Cincinnati State College and not have to worry about finances. The plan seemed impeccable. But then there's an old saying about the best laid plans. They just don't always work out. During the early morning hours of July 6th, 2007, Sarah would be shot to death. Her family believes that Sarah told her boyfriend that she was moving out of her apartment, breaking up with him, and starting a new life. Betsy said that Sarah's boyfriend had previously threatened her with harm if she ever tried to leave. It all started with a 911 call that came in just before 4 a.m. The call came from the boyfriend's mother. She stated, "My son shot his girlfriend. My son accidentally shot his girlfriend. He believes she's dead. They were fighting over the gun. The boyfriend claimed that Sarah was suicidal and wanted to kill herself. Allegedly, she picked up his gun and threatened to shoot herself. He claimed that he had tried to take the gun away from her, and during the struggle, she was shot dead. So maybe Sarah died, as the boyfriend claimed, but then maybe she didn't. I've read the coroner's report, listened to a portion of the 911 call, and I've spoken to Sarah's sister-in-laws. I have many concerns about Sarah's death. She died nearly 14 years ago, and her former boyfriend is still walking the streets. The case was brought in front of a grand jury, but they refused to take the case to trial. So let me share 5 points of interest that I have about Sarah's death. Point 1. One of Sarah's neighbors heard noises coming from her apartment. He then heard a gunshot and then silence. He was so disturbed that he grabbed his own gun and ran outside to investigate. He claimed that he saw Sarah's boyfriend and another man standing outside Sarah's apartment. The boyfriend was locking the door. The neighbor asked about the gunshot. The boyfriend told him there was no gunshot and everything was fine. And since the neighbor had seen the boyfriend before, he just accepted what he was told and returned to his own apartment. Point 2. How come the boyfriend didn't call 911 after Sarah was shot? Instead, he went to his parents' home and had his mother call 911. Sarah also lived near a fire station. Why didn't the boyfriend stop and ask for their help? I also wonder why he lied to the neighbor about not hearing a gunshot. I would think in most cases, a boyfriend who witnessed his girlfriend commit suicide would have asked the neighbor to help give CPR to his girlfriend and call for help. Yet none of this happened. The boyfriend just left Sarah in her apartment, locked the door, and left. Sarah had 2 working phones in her apartment. Why didn't the boyfriend use one of those to call 911? Point 3. Before Sarah was killed, the boyfriend was at a bar drinking. He began waving his gun around. The bartender took the gun away from him and held it until the boyfriend left. Why didn't the bartender call the police on the boyfriend? If the bartender had to confiscate the boyfriend's gun, that should have made law enforcement question the boyfriend's frame of mind. Think about what I just said. If I have to take away your gun, then that means that you gave me reason to suspect you are a threat to either harm or kill someone, which is why I just took away your weapon. Sarah would end up dead shortly after her boyfriend retrieved his gun back from the bartender. Point 4. I have a copy of the coroner's report. Sarah's death was originally ruled a homicide, but this changed after the boyfriend claimed that Sarah was depressed and suicidal. How was this claim supported? Law enforcement didn't thoroughly interview Sarah's family and inquire if she was suicidal. Betsy and Angela both told me that law enforcement never questioned them or Sarah's brothers about Sarah's mental state. They were her family. How do you accept the boyfriend's statement solely on his word without speaking to her family? Angela and Betsy said that Sarah wasn't depressed. She was ecstatic about moving on from her boyfriend, attending college, starting a career, and being a doting aunt. My final point is, I also read in the coroner's report that Sarah was sitting on her sofa when she was shot. Angela and Betsy saw a crime scene photo and said that Sarah sat in an Indian-style position. If Sarah and her boyfriend were fighting and struggling for a gun, how would she be just sitting there on the sofa slumped over? Allegedly, she struggled in a fight for her life. If this is true, why was she just sitting comfortably on her sofa and not lying on the floor or lying on the sofa? Also, the gun was found sitting on her lap, according to the report. So during this violent struggle, while sitting on the couch, she shoots herself and then casually drops the gun on her lap. I guess that's what we were supposed to believe. Unfortunately, the family doesn't believe the boyfriend will ever be charged unless he confesses. Betsy and Angela told me that they believe Sarah will never get justice because the original detective didn't do a thorough investigation. The coroner originally called this case a homicide. I've seen the document. So was it changed solely based on the boyfriend's statement about Sarah being suicidal? The family thinks so. This case is highly suspicious and troublesome to me, but I will leave it up to you to make your own decision. Now on with the story of Sarah Wallace, as told by family members, Betsy Wallace and Angela Walters. Tell me about your relationship with Sarah.
Sarah was born January 30th of 87. She had 3 older brothers. I didn't meet her until 99. I actually was dating her brother, and she was just always this little 12-year-old girl that was just the sweetest thing you'd be. Like, she would love to hang out with us, would do whatever with us. She was just funny. As she grew up into her teens, like, she made sure she took care of everybody. She tried to do stuff for every one of her friends, made sure nobody was left without. She just had that caring heart that actually took care of whoever needed her whenever she needed her. When she was working at CVS Pharmacy, and she made sure that all of her patients knew, she took the time of day to ask her patients how they were, and like, she would just talk to everybody. She made sure like everyone knew that she cared. She would give the shirt off her back to anybody, like, or the shoes off her feet to anybody that needed them.
And from what I understand, she had an interest in going back to school to become a nurse. Is that correct?
Right. She wanted to go back to school for like nursing or pharmacy technician, because she was already working at the pharmacy. So she was actually planning on going back that fall of that year she was killed. She was going back to school.
Now, you and Sarah are sister-in-laws. Is that correct?
Yeah, she's my sister-in-law. I am married to her oldest brother.
How was he handling the death of his sister? It can't be easy.
He's been letting me deal with it. I think that all the brothers are angry about the situation, but there's nothing anyone can do. I was always persistent about finding answers, asking questions, and I kept going to the police and talking to the police, saying, what's this? Asking every little way we could figure out anything. From day one, both myself and the other sister-in-law started retracing Sarah's steps. We went to the bars that she visited that night. We went to anybody we could knew that she was around that night and asked questions. We went to where she bought her cigarettes that night, like everywhere. We asked neighbors from the very same day, like time she was killed early in the morning to that very night. We were asking questions. We spent the whole day tracing her steps, figuring out where she was, what went wrong, how this happened.
Can you tell me about her boyfriend that was involved in the shooting? From what I understand, the case went to the grand jury, but he won't be prosecuted without additional evidence. And regarding the boyfriend, did you know him personally?
He was actually with that boyfriend for a year. I didn't know truly who he was. She tried to keep it private. He seemed, in my opinion, a little bit controlling, trying to like, hey, don't hang out with your sister-in-law, whatever type situation. But I made Sarah's business my business, so even though he would say no, I'd go over there anyway. Because that was Sarah. It didn't matter. We'd talk every day. Even if it was behind his back, she'd text me, or he'd be going out to his other places he would go to, and I'd hang out with Sarah. So we found a lot more information about him after the fact, like that he was actually still legally married, and that his wife actually lived at the house with his mother. We found a lot more information by asking questions, but he seemed really off. The case went to the grand jury, and we were told that we need more significant evidence before anything happened. There just isn't enough evidence from the time she was killed.
Can you tell me more about the day that Sarah died? How did you find out?
Sarah was killed July 6, 2007. July 4th that year, we had a family function. She came over. She was actually wearing a sweatshirt. Some of the cousins were questioning, why are you wearing a sweatshirt? And like, she was only there to help me with my newborn child at the time. So she stayed like maybe 20 minutes and then she left. She kept saying that he wants her home. He's worried that it's going to storm. It didn't storm that night. On July 5th, she texted me when she went to CVS. You know, her normal day, she went to CVS. And she actually had to work her second job that night, which is down at the ballpark, where both her dad and her brother saw her there as well. So she worked at the ballpark, got off work. I want to say she got off between 10:30 and 11. Drove home, which is about 20 minutes, dropped something off at her parents' house. Then she went to the bar where he was. He had been drinking there all day, and apparently he was aggressive and belittling her, according to the bar back. And they sat on the opposite ends of the bar for someone who's dating for almost a year, sitting at opposite ends of the bar, and it just didn't seem right. So she actually stayed there till, I want to say, 11:30, 12 o'clock. And then she decided she was going home. She drove her own car home. She actually stopped at CVS. The cashier at CVS has proof that she was alive at midnight, saying that she bought 2 packs of cigarettes and a Mountain Dew or something like that. And then she drove home. When she drove home, she actually talked to the neighbor that lived across the street. They were talking for like a good half hour is what we were told. So I'd put it like about 12:30, 12:45 is the last time she was seen alive. Somehow, her boyfriend got a ride from the bar from somebody, we don't know who it was. I guess they were arguing. He had a key to her apartment, so they were in her apartment. The story goes, he was in the apartment. A neighbor upstairs heard gunshots about 1:20, 1:15, 1:30 in the morning. She comes running down the stairs, and the boyfriend tells the neighbor that Sarah was just drunk and she tripped over the table, that there really wasn't any gunshots. However, that neighbor witnessed the boyfriend leaving, locking the door, then leaving the apartment complex. We were told someone else was also with him. We don't know who the other person is. We're not sure how accurate that is. Then somehow the boyfriend does not drive his own vehicle and does not drive Sarah's vehicle, gets a ride from his father, which in the police report it says his father picked him up. We figured it was a Jeep. We know from the neighbors a Jeep saw him pick him up and went home, where the boyfriend's mother called 911. If you look at the address of where Sarah's apartment was, there was a fire department within a minute. So the mother saying that accidentally went off, was such an accident, how come you didn't call for help right away? Doesn't make sense.
What was his response when asked about not calling 911 immediately?
We do not know his response. From the time this happened, we never had any contact with him or his family. They threatened to show up at the funeral, and the police made sure that wasn't going to happen. Obviously, there's a lot of talk, but they never reached out to us. His one sister put on social media back then, which is MySpace, is that what my brother's going through such a big thing or something like that. Like, he didn't do any of this, and nothing came of that either because it was a big joke. They never reached out to us. We never reached out to them. It just never crossed paths. That family actually, a few months later, left Ohio. The way we know that they're set up is that they all lived together or lived in the small vicinity of each other. Like, the would it be like him, his wife, his kids, his brother, his wife, her wife, what their wife, the kids, whatever, and the sister and their husband and the parents all live really close together. So they all packed up and left.
So let me know if I'm getting this all correct. There's a gunshot in the apartment, and the neighbor had heard some noises before the gunshot. The neighbor sees the boyfriend come out of the apartment, and he tells the neighbor that there was no gunshot. But the neighbor sees him lock the door and then just leave. And then the boyfriend, instead of calling 911 or telling the neighbor, I need help, or stop by the fire department, which is just down the road, he calls for a ride to his parents' house, and then his mother calls 911. And this happens 45 minutes after Sarah was shot. Why would he tell the neighbor that there was no gunshot when that was obviously not true? And why would he not tell the neighbor, hey, you know, my girlfriend got shot, could you call for help? You know, maybe you can come in the apartment and help me try to apply CPR. Either I'm missing something, or I'm just, something just doesn't sound right about this entire situation.
Somehow, whoever called his parents' house and the father picked him up. Instead of calling 911, he was able to call his mother and the father picked him up. So now where the other second person comes in, we have no idea who it could be. We don't know how he got back from the bar, because obviously we know he didn't walk from the bar. We don't know how, what he did after he locked the door. Oddly enough, like, Sarah's windows were all rolled down, both front side, the driver's side and passenger side. So we feel like that maybe he took Sarah's car for a drive. Whereas another rumor going around, after he shot Sarah, he supposedly went to a hotel where his other girlfriend was and confessed to his other girlfriend that he killed Sarah. That's another rumor that's going around.
For this part of the story, I spoke to Angela Walters, who is Sarah's former sister-in-law. The two women were great friends, and Angela shared her thoughts with me about Sarah's death.
What we didn't understand was that the mom called 911 and said, my son shot his girlfriend. That still wasn't enough for the police to arrest him. They didn't do the investigation however it should have been handled, because they went from homicide to suicide to accidental to undetermined. They took it in front of the grand jury. They didn't have enough to convict him.
Angela told me that the case is currently closed and authorities have provided the family with a copy of the case file. I began my interview with Angela by asking her to tell me about Sarah and what type of person that she was.
She was the sweetest person ever. Like, she would give you the shirt off of her back. In fact, she did give somebody the shirt off of her back one night when she was working. It was cold, and she actually gave them her sweatshirt so that they could stay warm. Like, literally gave her shirt off of her back. That's the kind of person she was. Above and beyond, nice, helpful in any way she could. You could call her at any moment, and she would come to help you with whatever you wanted help with. She was a great aunt. Loved her. Niece and nephew. I didn't get confirmation that her boyfriend was being abusive until our niece was born. And while we were at the hospital, I noticed a bunch of bruises that she kept telling me weren't nothing. And finally, she told me that he was abusive to her. And that's when we started figuring out how she could get away from him. And that was 6 or 7 days before she was killed. Betsy had made a plan with her to get her stuff together and get out of the house and come stay with Betsy while they figured out what the next steps could be, because he refused to give back the key to the apartment and she didn't know what else to do. Betsy was the first one to find out because her dad, I think it was, had left to go to the store or was coming home from work and noticed a bunch of police cars and knew that they were right by Sarah's apartment. So he wanted to check on Sarah. So Betsy started calling and didn't get a response. After several attempts, they went up there and then Betsy started calling all of us to let us know what was going on at, like, I think it was like 4 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, something like that, when we found out that she was killed.
When you first learned about Sarah's death, did you think it was an accident or did you automatically suspect it was foul play?
Automatic, because he had been abusing her already. He had threatened her prior to that. Like, she had tried to leave him several times and he threatened her.
Did she ever go to the police for help?
No. She thought she'd be able to handle it on her own. Yeah.
So she just confided in family members about domestic violence. And from what I understand, she had bruises on her arms that she tried to cover with clothing.
Yeah, she was, I believe that was at her grandma's house. They have barbecues and get-togethers. Well, they used to all the time. And yeah, it was hot out. Definitely not sweater weather. June in Cincinnati is not time to be having on a sweatshirt. So we noticed, but you know, when people aren't forthcoming with what is actually happening, can't really do anything to help them. So it was a get her to see that she couldn't do it on her own. She needed help. She needed to go to the police or, you know, we need to help her. And she finally agreed to let us help her. And then we weren't able to help her.
When did you first meet Sarah?
I was 17 years old when I met her. She was tagging along with us on something that we were doing, me and my ex-husband at the time. Whatever it was, I don't even remember what we were doing, but she just came and hung out with us. We went to like dinner or walking around Walmart or whatever, you know, things you do when you're 17 years old and there ain't nowhere to go. She was always just wanting to hang out. It doesn't matter what we do. We would go walk around the mall. We'd go and never buy anything. I mean, we just spend hours just walking around and shooting the shit. Nothing major. Problems with her parents. Didn't really get along with them very well, but she was a really good person. A lot of the time, the family, when me and my ex-husband got together, the family didn't like me, but she never believed in those things. She like, I don't care what people say. I want to know about you by me learning about you, not by what other people say, which was different. That in itself makes her different than the majority of people, nicer than most people. The fact that she's like, well, let me get to know you myself and see how I feel about you and not what they say I should feel about you.
What I find so tragic about this case is that she was only 20, so her life had not even begun.
No, she was definitely cut short by a lot. I mean, you could probably still go into some places and mention her name And they'd be like, she was so sweet. She helped with whatever she could help with. Some of the people that she had worked with would ask for updates on the case. It was a shock to everybody.
Was this guy her first boyfriend?
I want to say yes, only because they stayed together. I think so. Yeah, I don't remember meeting anybody else. Take that back. There was Carl. She was with Carl for a while. Carl was a really nice guy to her. She liked to try to help and fix people. So that was one of her downfalls. When you got the personality and the mentality that you want to help them, you want to fix them, they're not broken, they just need extra love or forgiveness or whatever, then you don't really see how bad they really are.
The reason why I ask is because of her young age. I figured at the age of 20, she stuck with the guy that didn't treat her well. I mean, a lot of times I know that that's a first relationship and you've never been in a bad one, so you really don't know what to expect. But when you've experienced bad behavior, you kind of recognize it down the road due to her inexperience in relationships, that maybe she tolerated more off of this guy because it was her first serious relationship. So after Sarah died, how did the investigation unfold? What are your thoughts about the investigation? How did law enforcement handle the boyfriend that had shot Sarah?
He was picked up and questioned, and then they let him go. And that upset us a lot, that they just let him go. His mom said he did it. Why are you letting him go? The way I understand it is the whole family, his whole family, had the same story. They were arguing. She picked up the gun, threatened to kill herself. He didn't know what to do, so he left, is what the story was that they told police. And then we were like, that's not adding up. Why would he say he shot his girlfriend if he said he left? So then they brought him in again, and he said that he was trying to stop her, and the gun went off, and he didn't know what to do, so he left. The thing about him saying that he left is that he didn't have a car. So he had to either wait for a ride or walk or take her car. We don't know how that happened. Apparently, the dad picked him up and took him back home. We don't know how long after she had been shot, the dad came and got him. And why didn't they, if it was an accident, call 911 immediately? Because there's fire department less than a block and a half away.
That doesn't make any sense to me. I find it hard to believe that law enforcement would buy a story like that. It just doesn't even sound right.
Right. So me and Betsy weren't happy with what the police were saying and who they were or were not talking to. So we decided to go and start talking to people and see what we could find out. There were, I think, one or two people who had said that he had told them that he shot her. When we told the police that and gave them their names, they said that they were not, that was just hearsay because they couldn't prove that they heard it directly from him. And then there was a girl, I don't remember what her name is. She said that he had come to her at the Red Roof Inn on Coleraine and said he came to her room with blood on him and was freaking out but wouldn't tell her what happened. And then he cleaned himself up and then he left. I don't know if police even ever talked to her. And then the guy, one of the guys who lived in the apartment up and across the hall from where she lived, he said he heard a gunshot, and then he heard arguing what sounded like somebody moving furniture around, and then a gunshot, and then door slamming. And then about 5 minutes later, nothing. And then he went and grabbed his own gun and went out into the hallway to see what was going on. He was the only guy who lived in that four family apartment building. And he kind of like watched out for everybody. But he said he saw two people leave her apartment and told him that everything was fine. Since he had seen the one person before, he didn't think anything of it and just went back to bed. So we were trying to figure out, was there really a second person there? Never did figure that out either.
But the guy did say he saw two people there though, correct?
Right. So we don't know if that was his dad like picking him up, or if that was somebody else that was there with him at the time and the dad picking him up was a lie or what. We don't know.
Do you know if the police spoke to that neighbor?
I don't know.
Do you know if they checked both of their hands for gunpowder residue? I'm guessing that there should have been some either on her hand, his hand, or both of their hands if they were supposedly fighting over a gun.
He was wrestling with her with the gun. that would explain if he had gunpowder on his hand. She had, I believe, had it on her left hand, and she's right-handed.
Okay, so you said that when this first happened, I had read in a Fox News article that I believe they had mentioned that it was a homicide, but you said the cause of death changed several times.
Betsy was on top of getting paperwork. She got the first on-scene report, and it says homicide. And then once the investigation started, I guess because of what he was saying, they put accidental and possible suicide. And then the detective that first had it started saying that it was a suicide because she had had a history of depression. So it was probably a suicide since she had a history of depression. His story could easily check out, which didn't fit because she wasn't depressed. She was on her meds. It was controlled. Plus, she just had a new niece. Doesn't fit. But he took it in that direction. I believe the coroner originally wanted to say homicide. And since the investigation was leading towards suicide, or the way they were handling the investigation was leading towards suicide, which I think is why there wasn't as much of an investigation going on, honestly, because that detective was either just didn't want to deal with it or was like, oh, well, he has a history of depression. So it's like that it went undetermined on the death certificate, I believe. I think it says undetermined on there. I'm not 100% positive on that, though.
And they've since closed the case, correct?
Yeah, they closed the case because the most recent detectives that were on it was looking through the case and was like, this doesn't make sense. Stuff's not adding up here. There's more questions than answers with what we have. So they got permission from Cincinnati, however that works, to go to Texas. So they went down to Texas to question him, and his story stayed the same. And it still didn't add up to them. And they questioned him as long as they could. The press here is like, well, let's go in front of the grand jury, see what they think, and see if we can, you know, move forward and get an arrest warrant and whatever. And they said there wasn't enough evidence. So when we had our meeting with them, they said, short of him walking into the police station and saying, hey, I killed Sarah Wallace, he would never be charged because there's no way new evidence is going to come forward, like no physical evidence. And that's basically it.
I saw that you have a Facebook page for Sarah, and I have gone through it a few times and read some of the articles and just looked at photos. Now, if you don't think that the case is going to be resolved, what is the purpose of having the page then?
Just to remember. It's more of a, at this point, I think it's more of a remember thing now that they closed the case. At first it was, we're looking for new information, hoping somebody heard him say something, or since we can't use his name, it makes it a little harder. At first it was, you know, if he said something, let us know what you know. What do you know? Anybody know anything about that night, days leading up to it, anything like that? Then it was, make sure we got stuff up there about domestic violence. I mean, short of his, like, a wife coming in and being like, hey, my husband said that he killed this girl. And I don't think anything would change with it, unfortunately. We all know he did it. We think it's because she was planning on leaving.
My last question for you would be, do you think that you will ever see justice for Sarah? I mean, is it even a possibility?
No. I honestly think that that first detective screwed the whole thing up because he didn't investigate all possibilities. There's not going to be justice for her. As you can see, he's walking around free in Texas or Tennessee. He's lived in a lot of different places since then. And when we look through the case file, it was mostly just his version, all the different interviews they had with him. It just didn't add up. Like, even reading through the case file, I don't think I've ever read through the whole thing. I think it ended up being like 500 pages or something like that.
While looking through the case file, was there anything that really stood out as unusual?
She was found sitting on her couch, sitting Indian style, slumped over. If that sounds like a way that you would be sitting when you're struggling over a gun, that doesn't fit. You're not going to be sitting Indian style on the couch. If you're fighting over a gun, that's not going to happen. You're going to be up. You're going to be moving around. You're not going to be sitting comfortably.
No, not at all.
Rolling around something. Right. You're not just going to be sitting comfortably.
Yeah, it's definitely questionable.
I didn't know that's how she was found until the meeting with the investigator and prosecutor when they told us that they closed the case. Which they warned us before we saw it. They're like, okay, there's crime scene photos in there. Be prepared. me and Betsy looked at each other for a second and we're like, we want to know how she was when she was found to see if any of this stuff fit. We only looked at that one picture though. It was not something that you would think of seeing as a suicide or an accidental shooting. And the fact that there was gunpowder residue on her left hand, I don't think there was any on her right. That doesn't make sense either, because as far as I know, she never really handled a gun or fired a gun. And fire a gun with your non-dominant hand isn't something that would be easy to do. You wouldn't be able to control where it goes. I mean, I haven't fired many guns, but a couple of times that I have, even BB guns, it pulls your hand. It doesn't necessarily go where you point if you don't have full control over it. You use your right hand to hold your left hand underneath your right hand. You're right-handed. That's what you do. I mean, even if, say, she was just looking at it and it was accidental, somehow managed to pull the trigger. The wound was on the side of her neck, on the left side of her body. With the position she was sitting in, even if she was just fiddling around with it, there isn't a way for the angle to work out that was in the autopsy report in my brain, because it said something about a downward motion, but the angle didn't make sense of how it would work for it to be an accident unless somebody was standing above her, is what I've always thought in my mind, like how that angle would work is somebody standing above her.
After my interview with Angela, I concluded this week's story with more of Betsy's insight about Sarah's death. There's another thing that bothers me about this case. The articles that I've seen claim that the boyfriend called 911, but I did hear the 911 call, a portion of it, and it was actually his mother that called. So I'm not quite sure why the conflict, but I do know that in the 911 call, the mother said that her son had shot his girlfriend. Can you tell me a little bit more about the 911 call?
The 911 call, there was one from a neighbor upstairs saying there's a lot of ruckus going on, like somebody's kicking in the door, which was the police kicking in the door. His mother called 911 stating that my son shot his girlfriend. She is dead. They were fighting over the gun and went off.
I'm not exactly sure what he told police officers about the shooting, but whatever he said, it must have been convincing because he's still walking around free right now, all these years later.
I have no idea. We're not privileged to know what he said because it was blocked out when the case, since the case is closed, all because of Miranda rights. We're not allowed knowing what he said in case the case ever goes back to a trial, if we ever get enough evidence.
What were the circumstances leading up to you finding out about what happened to Sarah?
I want to say it was like 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. And my dad was driving to work and my mom and dad started calling me saying something's going on at Sarah's apartment. Because everyone lived really close to each other, like a couple streets away. So you'd have to drive past her to go to my dad's work. They start calling me and like, then my mom stops at my house and says something's going on at Sarah's apartment. So calling Sarah, no answer. Start calling her over and over on multiple phone lines, no answer. I called her mother. Her mother goes over there, and then she texted us saying he killed her. She's dead. You know, obviously, everyone starts showing up right away to see what's going on. Like, we all were in a short distance from her apartment. So we were all there within a matter of minutes after she went over there. And, like, it's just something we drove by it. We saw it on the news, and then they released her name like a couple hours later. That moment we got there, her father told them to talk to me. The police stopped and asked, you know, for my number, saying that they would call me and question me and talk to me. They never called me or questioned me. I've waited. Like, from the day one, like, they were supposed to question me and one of her brothers, and neither of us got a phone call. Nobody was asked questions. Nobody was asked to come in. Nothing. I guess when our dad went down there, he was already being questioned, like at 5 o'clock in the morning, whatever.
Do you know what led up to her death? I mean, was there an argument? Were they fighting over something? So either Sarah was mad at her boyfriend or he was mad at her, because it sounds like they probably got into some kind of a fight. What have you heard?
I think Sarah found out that he was lying. When they first met, he actually gave her a fake name. And he was telling her that he was going to leave his wife and, you know, all the situation that, you know, he wants to be with Sarah. He's going to divorce his wife, be together. Sarah literally said that, you know, they have until July of that year to say, hey, yeah, we're going to be together. We're not going to be together. She's going to be done with it. Well, I think she was done. July 6th was her 1 year anniversary from what I understood. Right. Cause I know the year before they were together, they met each other around that time. I think the ultimatum that Sarah gave him was, hey, leave your wife or we're not going to be together. And we already had plans. But as I said, I had my infant was 10 days old. When Sarah visited me in the hospital, we made plans that Sarah was going to come live with myself and her brother. And then she's going to save up and go back to school and not worry about paying a rent. We reached out to the landlord to end her contract, but he killed her. The same day she was supposed to leave that weekend, he killed her, is what we believe. And now we actually have, I want to say survivors of his psychological abuse have come forward that were before Sarah and after Sarah and during Sarah. And have shared their view of him and how he was and what he does and like how abusive he really is. We've had different people reach out through the page over the years, it's going on 14 years, that he said, hey, I saw him in a bar. He said that he was drinking and he told us what he did. Yeah, he got away with it. Like, so he's bragging about it. But, you know, this is hearsay and like we can't use any of that anyway. And like we need him to confess to the correct person.
I think it's definitely beneficial that people are reaching out to the page with their experiences with this guy. Have any of them provided written statements? I'm guessing that's a possibility that they would if asked.
Not really notarized statements. We've actually had the witnesses come forward and actually directly talk to the police, and the police have actually questioned them. We followed up every trail. The police have questioned them, and we've actually had people that were really close to them say different statements as well.
So then there is records of people who have come to your page and left comments and then have also given information about this individual to the police.
Yeah, there's a bunch of them. Like anybody we questioned, like that night, whoever we questioned, they actually reached out to the police and police followed up with them. Some of her coworkers, they were followed up with their coworkers just to give her character about who she was. And then some other like other survivors were following up with the police as well. So we had all this roundabout, you know, all these stories, all these statements from what happened and like what he's done and his character, and yet nothing could ever be done. You can't charge somebody on their character.
I fail to understand why this guy didn't get indicted when his case went in front of the grand jury. Were you given any specific reasons as to why they chose not to indict him?
We were told there was not enough evidence. And I don't know where the evidence lies. Like, we just had this gut feeling that, you know, not that Hamilton kind of didn't do their job, but maybe they believe the fact that them saying that, you know, his parents were questioned and he was questioned, saying, oh, she was suicidal or stuff like that. That in the media, said it was either homicide, accidental shooting, or suicide. It was one day media coverage, and that's all Sarah Gates ever got. For some reason, like, there wasn't enough evidence gathered at the scene. There wasn't enough, I don't feel like there was enough statements gathered from each of the siblings or the sister-in-laws, like they said they would question everybody or talk to all of us about her character. Because at the end, Sarah is closest to myself and one of her brothers, and neither myself or her brother were questioned or talked to. We waited for them to call us and say, hey, let's, you know, help build Sarah's character witness their character. But nobody ever reached out to us, which didn't make sense. I understand that they talked to her parents, but that's it. Everybody who was around Sarah the last few days was not talked to.
Realistically, they probably should have spoken to everybody, because I'm thinking that if you're going to consider the idea of suicide, then talking to people that knew the deceased is going to help. For instance, let's say that you talk to 50 of Sarah's friends and all 50 of them say, oh, no, she wasn't suicidal. She wasn't depressed. Then you have to take that into consideration. If it's me and I'm investigating, I'm probably not going to lean on the suicide theory if I speak to 50 people who say that they don't believe she was in that state of mind. So I'm not clear why anybody would want to stay with that.
He's confessed to different people saying he actually accidentally did it, but his mother's the one that's saying he accidentally did it. You know, whatever happened in the house, by the time they went back to the house and whoever had to wake up his wife, tell his wife, oh, whatever, hey, I killed her. You know, whatever he did, telling his wife, his sister, his brother, whoever lived in that house with them, they all had time to make a story. when they question his parents, why would they question his parents and then question his wife and then maybe talk to his siblings? Why didn't they talk to any of her siblings? Why didn't she bring in her family, her side, to say who she was? Our side shows who she is. Like, I will never back down from this because, like, I know who she was. I know she wouldn't do this.
What did the coroner's report state?
It's ruled undetermined. It says a gunshot wound, and it tells you where the gunshot was, and it's probably bled out and died within minutes to seconds, but doesn't say anything other than undetermined. So there's not enough evidence to back up homicide and not enough evidence to back up suicide.
It sounds like the case is pretty much just in limbo then.
Absolutely.
After Sarah was killed, I imagine the family kept in contact with law enforcement pretty regularly. What was the experience with them? How did they treat the family regarding the investigation?
For a while, her parents were in charge of contacting the law enforcement, and they were contacting them, and it took like almost a month for their apartments to be released, and they trusted that they would get back to them, that they would have more information. Yeah, but a month goes by, nothing happens. Another month goes by, nothing happens. It just keeps going and nothing's happening. Finally, after a few months, I started calling, asking questions, as well as did my other sister-in-law at the time. We asked questions. We were constantly calling. And it turned into, I was calling a couple times a month to once a week. Towards the end, I was calling every few days because I wanted to know, because we actually had people come forward saying who he was and his showing his character. And I would follow up, make sure anybody who called or messaged the page was followed up by the police. So I had to constantly send emails, give information back and forth, save the emails that were sent to us. I made sure that they were talked to, and they did get talked to. They did go down to different states where people were coming forward and did question them. They followed up towards the end, but nothing ever happened. It's all hearsay. Like I said, he said she's dead, and that's all we have from it, because there's not enough evidence to charge him, but we believe he did, especially for being the last one to see her alive. We're not sure if this other person really exists, because we never got a name for this other person, or was this other person really a family member of his? But that doesn't go along with the story either. But I was calling the police for a couple weeks, last year and a half, 2 years, every week, if not a couple times a week, just trying to talk to somebody. They were respecting me, talking to me, answering my questions. Even after they gave us the case files, I questioned everything. I researched everything. I asked questions for the first couple months. Obviously, it died down because they closed the case and nothing's come of it yet.
In your opinion, are we ever going to see any justice for Sarah?
Even Sarah not being here, she'd want to protect the next person. I don't think there's anything that's ever going to be charged with him. Our goal is always to protect the next one, so there's not a next homicide or family that has to deal with the fact that he killed someone else's daughter. And that's what our goal is to do. I don't think anything will come of it. We'd love for him to be charged, but realistically, I don't think that's going to happen.
I'd like to commend you for keeping Sarah's memory alive. I think it's great that you and her family continue doing so. I know justice sometimes can be painfully slow, but I don't think you should ever give up on trying to get justice for her. If anybody did have any information, who would they contact with that information?
If there is any more information out there, they can contact the Hamilton County Police Department. They're more than willing to listen to whatever you have to say about it. Or you can message the page and I can actually help get a hold of somebody and try to find who needs to be talked to. But directly to the police is easier, because that way we're not jumping through hoops and they're not backing out of trying to stay their side versus they get scared.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your Facebook page? And what is it called?
It's Justice for Sarah Wallace. We created it, I want to say, maybe 8 years ago or more. And it's just a page where Sarah's friends and stuff like that, and anybody can see Sarah's story. We've had people reach out who are previously or currently in domestic violence. And we're just there, and we'll sit there and talk to someone if we need someone to talk to, and we're just there.
The last question that I would have for you is, for anyone that's listening to the podcast, they have any information that could help Sarah's family get justice, what would you say to that person or persons?
If anyone knows anything over the past 14 years of us waiting for justice, if you know something, you haven't said something, just go forward. If not, it's time. There's no more waiting for it. We need to get him off the streets so he stops hurting females. We don't care how long it's been. for Sarah, we want justice.
And that concludes the story of Sarah Wallace. What happened to her nearly 14 years ago? The family has refused to accept that Sarah's death was either an accident or a suicide. They have put together a Facebook page for Sarah and have received messages from former girlfriends of the boyfriend, and none of them are glowing reviews about him. Although Sarah's family doesn't think Sarah will ever receive justice, I am hopeful that someone will listen to Sarah's story and come forth with information or evidence that can change this entire case. If you have any knowledge about Sarah's death, please contact the Hamilton County, Ohio Sheriff's Department at 513-946-6400, or you can reach out to Sarah's family through their Facebook page titled Justice for Sarah Wallace. The family will share your tips with law enforcement. I will also include the details in the podcast story notes, and if you are a parent, law enforcement official, friend, or relative seeking justice for an unsolved homicide case, please visit my website and complete the contact form or contact me through Facebook. Thank you for listening.